How's it hanging, everybody? Welcome back to another week at Tag Team. I'm your host, Riley Holbert, joined by my two good friends, Mr. Andrew Mahone and Mr. JW Kriwal. Guys, how's it hanging today?
Yo, what's up?
What's up?
How you doing, Riley?
I'm doing really good, man. Like I said, over the last few weeks, I've reclaimed my zen. I kind of lost it towards the end of last week, but I entered this week manifesting good vibes. The moon is waxing. It's almost a full moon, which is a good sign. It's a good sign for all of us. Yeah, so
it's almost the harvest moon. Tomorrow night into Friday morning is a harvest moon. I was just listening to this on NPR. And so what's happening is it's the full moon at the moon's closest point to the Earth.
Yo.
So it's going to be a full, like, just
this,
like,
is big.
A brilliant moon.
It's
called a harvest moon because apparently the light was so bright back, you know, when
you could harvest under the moonlight.
You could harvest under the moonlight.
Wow. I was actually going to ask you why it's a harvest moon. So I'm really glad you had that trivia, like, ready to pluck.
I know, dude. Nobody picks me for their trivia teams at the bars, but maybe they should.
Maybe
longer work days, baby. Longer work days. That's the harvest moon. Let's go.
How are you all doing? What's going on in your guys' life?
I'm doing great. I am very excited because last weekend I got to chill. I didn't have to go anywhere, so I've been very busy as of late, and it was nice. I went to a League Cup. I top eighted it with Zorro Box.
So sick.
You know, on the board with Zorro Box this season. King. I wanted to try it and just get it out there and see.
Yeah.
And I lost to a Turbo Palkia deck. See, that was tough because they could just not use their V-Star power, and then the Raichu doesn't do anything.
No.
They just manually power up their attackers.
They just melody every turn and just kind of kill, yeah.
Yikes.
Yeah, so, and then they also have the, double cross switcher canceling cologne, Radiant Greninja, your guys for game, kind of.
Plus, they play Lost Cities.
Yeah, it just gets gnarly real quick. It was not good. I think it was my worst matchup in top eight. But I think also, playing Zorro Box, at a tournament, I think it made me realize that I don't want to take that to a regional. So it was nice. I kind of got the monkey off my back. Yeah. I don't have to think about it anymore.
Right, well, burden removed.
We had kind of been thinking about that as like a little spicy little deck. Heading into Peoria.
Yes, I mean, it's got cool things. It definitely smacks Charizard, which is really nice because that is now apparently a top deck that we all need to worry about.
And we'll talk about that a little bit later in the cast.
Definitely.
Yeah. How you doing, JW?
Hey, good. I this weekend, speaking of, you know, you not doing anything, I traveled up to Chicago and went to a wedding, but it wasn't just any wedding. It was an Indian wedding. And it wasn't just any Indian wedding. The Indian wedding probably ballpark, I estimate, like, I think on the low end, probably $250,000 went into this wedding. Just with all the food, the accommodation. I mean, they do it up big, dude, but it was amazing. So they had a video crew, probably four videographers, and they were videotaping like the whole day so that during the reception, they could have video playing of the ceremony. And things. And
oh my gosh.
I know. It was like, it just really was.
Like a fan cam. Like, did they have fan cams, dude?
Movie stars. Kind of, yeah.
Like, yeah, someone's crazy. Going around with a video camera, like, look, you're on TV.
Well, not quite like that, but it was pretty wild, though. And the food was amazing. And of course, they got married, which was really nice. And
also, the wedding part. Yeah.
Yeah, the wedding was good, too. Yeah. But everything else surrounding the wedding was impeccable.
Awesome. Well, it sounds like the vibes are immaculate across the board. So I can't think of a better way to continue that than to talk about slow play in the Pokemon community. Who's with me, guys? So this is the hot thing right now, right? Is timing rules as they relate to competitive Pokemon. So to kind of set the stage for those of you who maybe haven't attended a large tournament in a while, Pokemon tournaments are played in best of three 50-minute rounds. So you have 50 minutes to complete three games, which honestly is not enough for three full, like, participatory games of the Pokemon trading card game, especially like in current day when there's a lot of actions per turn being done. And this sort of naturally calls into question, you know, what is an appropriate pace of play? How can the clock be used and abused? And we have a star of that show, certainly, and some high profile players who certainly allegedly use that system to their benefit. So that's kind of stage setting here. Andrew, you've been sort of plugged into the drama. You know, lay out what's been actually happening on the ground.
Yeah. So that I think you set the stage perfectly. And to kind of continue setting that stage, yes, we have 50 minutes best of three. And the Scarlet and Violet era of the Pokemon TCG is becoming much more nuanced. I mean, in years and formats past, tag team Pokemon GX just kind of slugging at each other, taking three prizes at a time. Pokemon VMAX one hit KOing each other for three prizes at a time. You know, 50 minutes best of three has never been enough for three full games of Pokemon, really, but it wasn't as bad during those times, which took up, I mean, almost, you know, all of the last handful of years. And then not to mention you have the pandemic years where nobody's actually playing, you know, like very high stakes tournaments. So you don't actually have like the format being picked apart as much as it would be otherwise. And certainly not tabletop 50 minute best of three. Even at that, you've got online tournaments, which timing is pretty much a non-issue. And now we've got these slower decks that are popular, most notably Gardevoir, right? And Gardevoir is definitely the deck that is kind of like at the forefront of the conversation because it is a slower deck with a lot of game actions. And there's like almost no way you're completing three full games in 50 minutes, just straight up. You're just not, right? And the best Gardevoir player in the world right now is Tord Reklev, right? And he just finished in the finals of the World Championships. He had a great run at the North American International Championships as well. And he has been playing this deck for, you know, pretty much in front of everybody for everybody to see exactly how he pilots it and how he comes away, you know, with wins, especially in scenarios where it's I win a 30-minute game one, a 35-minute game one, and then game two does not conclude, right? And the drama, really, the kernel of this kind of all started, I think, during his NAIC run or right after. There was a game on stream where he won a long game one and then game two didn't conclude. And, you know, and questions came up about what is slow play like. You know, in game two, you're not really playing to, like, finish the game. and Tord acknowledged that as much on Twitter and said, it's a problem with the way that the rules are right now, because the way that 50 minute best of three works in Pokemon is that if game one concludes and then game two doesn't, the player who won game one wins the entire set. So he kind of brought it to a head and said, it's a problem with the rules, you know, in that the game asks you, a competitive player, to ask the question, what is the slowest legal pace of play? Because at any time in the series, there's going to be one player that maybe doesn't want the current game to conclude,
right?
Because of the way that the structure is set up. So because the rules beg you to ask, what is the slowest legal pace of play? You have the most competitive players in the world, like Tord, who are towing that line every single tournament and asking the question in public, on stream, in front of everybody, for everybody to see and pick apart. And then I don't know what regional championship it was that Tord was playing at most recently, or the special event. Do you guys know what event it was?
Was it Lille?
Was it Lille?
Or Barcelona.
Barcelona, I believe.
It was, yeah. Barcelona. So Tord, the most recent, I mean, it's like in this conversation, it's been kind of ongoing since NAIC with lots of people proposing different things. Some people are saying, no, we cannot ditch 50 minute best of three. Some people are saying we should do chess timers, which I think is a horrible idea. It's not actually ever going to work. Do not say chess timers in my in my vicinity. I will shut you down. It's not happening. Okay. Logistical nightmare. They're not going to do chess timers. So then the easier
idea, by the way, I really think they are. I mean, That's we're not gonna go down that rabbit hole, but I think they're that's not a troll. That's, I think they're a great idea if they, like you said, logistical nightmare, but I think that they make a lot of sense. And obviously, like, the most popular game in the world, or one of, chess uses them, so we could also, but I digress. We don't have to go down that rabbit hole.
I mean, judge, I feel like God bless the judges, okay? But, like, I feel like judges already got a lot on their plate. The idea of adding chess clocks and thousands of dollars of equipment into the equation, especially when you got junior players and senior players, and you got... Yeah,
you don't do it for the lower divisions. It's like a very simple, right? It's a very simple idea.
And so chess clocks are one of the worst ideas brought up, but there's a lot of different ideas.
The worst idea. It's
definitely the worst idea that's been brought up.
I don't want to derail this conversation, but I do feel like I have to stand up for a chess clock, man. Like, it's very impartial. Like, think of the benefits, right? It's impartial. You get your 25 minutes. You're talking about, oh, how would players, like, enact it? I mean, I don't know. It's the same as, like, chess people figure it out. Like, okay,
no, it is absolutely. I'm going to come in here. And Andrew, you can bat later if you want. It is not the same. I'm going to give you a couple examples. Number one, escape rope. I play escape rope.
Okay.
Do I have to swap the timer over to you?
Sure. Sure.
Number two, you are checking my discard pile in the middle of my turn, and I need you to return my discard pile to me before I can take my game action. Whose timer is being used during that instance?
Okay.
Number three. I have performed a game action and I'm shuffling my deck. I hand it to you. You start shuffling my deck. Whose timer is being used?
Okay, checkmate.
Okay. Checkmate on the chess timer. Okay.
No, I think Riley really hit that one out of the park. And see, so what you're introducing more questions that don't need to be answered, okay? just like the question of, you know, what's
but
the slowest legal place to play?
Well, so like, does it get us closer to fair play? Because this is where this whole conversation is leading to.
So
now we can kind of go into
right
where your main point here.
Yes. Is we have 50-minute best of three. The game is not designed to be a 50-minute best of three game. And I think that that's one of the most important points to realize. This is a game that is designed in Japan for 25-minute best of one Swiss. That is the way this game is designed, you know, at its core. 50-minute best of three, for those of you that don't know, is just a tournament structure that was imported from Magic the Gathering to Pokemon with almost no changes. It is not a structure that fits our game. It just is a structure for the most popular trading card game, which is quite different than Pokemon if you've ever played them. There's almost no deck searching. There's very little shuffling. I mean, and games just go much quicker, you know? They just do. The flow of Magic and 50 best of three is great. It works fantastic. And but then, you know, is single game Swiss, you know, that's not without its own problems. But I think it is worth noting that that is how the game is designed to be played, with all of the RNG and everything that comes with it. That's just part of the Pokemon TCG experience from the way that it is designed. You may disagree with that, but that is how the game is designed in Japan. So then there, you know, Tord proposed after Nationals that you try a 50-minute two-game series where each player gets to go first once. You flip to see which player goes first, and then you are awarded 1 point per win. So both players are incentivized to try and win, because if you win twice, if you win twice, you get 2 points. You win once, you get 1 point, right?
Yeah, it's funny that Tord mentioned that, because you look back in, what, like 2018, 2017, and a friend of all of ours, Andrew Wamble, actually proposed a similar structure on his website, the Charizard Lounge. He wrote a really great article about sort of the pros and cons of the different options available to us, like best of two, best of one, best of three. I've always actually kind of been partial to that idea. I think it's not a bad proposal to the problem. I struggle to actually see Pokemon implementing it, to be honest, because I feel like that's the furthest away from what people are used to. And so it, like, carries a lot of inertia with it, right? Whereas best of one is, like, a much more, you know, people play best of one all the time. They play it with their friends. They play it in league challenges. Best of Two is like a whole new concept that would have to be like introduced and put into people's minds.
Yeah, what I still, when I think about Best of One versus Best of Two versus Best of Three, particularly the Best of One versus Best of Three, which are kind of the two proposals that Pokemon has actually had tournaments under, the two structures that Pokemon has had tournaments under, I am more partial to Best of Three, having played significant time in Best of One regionals. It is always better to have more games to decide how your tournament run goes than less games. I would make that argument. But at the same point, Best of Two is a really interesting idea in that whenever there is a, whenever there's an incentive for a player not to play the game, that's going to lead to these issues of time that we're talking about.
So I think there are a few things, and actually the rule was changed, right? That if a game doesn't conclude, that the set is awarded to the player that did win one game, right? And that was changed literally because of somebody abusing the system. Jason Klasinski, the 2015 national champion, right? And the reason it was changed is because Jason was playing against a deck that he could not beat the traditional way. It was a stall deck, and he was not going to be able to take six prizes. So he lost like a 40-minute game one, and then all he had to do was make sure that he had taken more prizes than his opponent, easy, because his opponent doesn't take prizes, the stall deck. He just had to make sure he had taken enough prizes. It's like four prizes to conclude. Yes. So, and that seems, it's like you could see why the rules were that way, because you're incentivizing, the player to conclude the game, or to get as close to finishing the game as possible in the set legal amount of time. And then since Jason had taken four prizes when time was called, right, and didn't get decked out before time was called, then it goes to sudden death, where Jason obviously just wins.
Well, and
right?
The thing about sudden death that was bad back then was that you didn't actually set out six prizes. You set out one prize. And the problem with setting out one prize in sudden death back then in 2015, U.S. Nationals, was that there was a card called N, which is similar to Iono, where you would shuffle your hand in and draw one single card. So obviously a stall deck is going to struggle having two cards to start their turn, which is exactly what happened. Wasn't able to get up enough stuff. And then Jason takes the prize to end the series.
Right. And so when you start thinking about 50, and I bring that up because it's just a great story and it's great lore for the history of our game and how the rules got to where they are. But you bring that up because I think it exemplifies perfectly why Best of Three just isn't working in our game. You try it this way where it's like, okay, well, we're going to nix the whole, like, you win a long game one, you win the set strat, right? By making it so that the player who maybe is close to winning game two wins, and then you have to go to sudden death. It's like, that's a lot. We can see why that didn't work. So then you kind of have to have the long game one strat, but then you got players who win a 30-minute game one are just gonna be like, all right, shut it down. Game two is not happening, baby. Yeah. And it's like, you see that enough times on stream, and you realize, like, we can't actually continue doing this, right? You can't have your most competitive best players in the world playing against the spirit of the game and asking themselves, what's the slowest legal pace of play? So the only realistic option is to change the rules, in my opinion.
I think one thing that is worth noting is Jason's instance of time abuse was also at Top Cut, right? I don't think any solution proposes removing Best of Three from Top Cut.
No. So. Best of Three will always exist in Top Cut. Everybody is in agreement with that. Well, you've always got time.
Best of Three plus extra time, right? So yes. Either 60 or 75 minutes, depending.
Right, and I think that is also a differentiator of Top Cut, though, is that you do have that extra time. Jason's situation was particularly unique because his deck was slow and his opponent's deck was a stall deck. So there's a lot of turnage, a lot of, like, nickel and diming of damage going back and forth there.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Riley.
Yeah, and I at some level I agree with you, right? Where the rules as they are laid out and the iterations that have been tried always are going to open themselves up to some level of abuse. I do tend to agree with you in some ways, JW, that like having more games will, in aggregate, let the better players win more often. So I want to play devil's advocate a little bit there. The most recent iteration of Best of One, in my opinion, was in a much more toxic era of the game in terms of like what you could do to your opponent in the earliest turns of the game. You know, you think of like HGSS era when Tyrogues were clomping on each other. Like, you don't have anything like that anymore. And like having entire rounds of your regional being lost to that in a best of one setting. So that's good. That's true. Good. Yeah. You don't have turn one supporters anymore. So in addition to like turn one attacks, you don't have crazy things like Pokemon Catcher anymore. So like the game is a little more rate limited than it was before. Now, granted, you still have some pretty toxic like early game cards that can like make or break an entire game, namely Battle VIP paths. But I don't think in aggregate, like I think best of one versus best of three, you're still seeing like the better players are winning the most often. Would you disagree with that?
Sure. But it is just less games, right?
Sure.
And so that's ultimately, I think I would be happy if it was best of one and we had whatever, 19, 20, 21 rounds, right? But that's not realistically possible. So we are kind of towing this line. Do you have 14 in day one, best of one rounds, or do you have 9 best of three? Again, I would tend to favor the best of threes in that situation.
Sure. I would also agree that I would want more rounds in best of one. I think you could easily add 2 or 3 without like changing the landscape of the day too much. I think it's a little tough. And I think one thing that both styles need to consider is sort of the between round logistics. You know, one of the hardest parts of Pittsburgh in the early rounds was the match slip, like turn in and match turn around. It improved substantially as the day went on and people were dropping. But that is a factor to certainly consider. Adding more rounds adds more of that time. But I think you could sub in like easily 2 to 3 rounds and still, like, when you count for the fact that best of one is so much shorter than best of three.
So here's a question then.
Sure.
To kind of bring this back into, you know, what's currently happening. We saw it on stream. We've maybe seen it a couple times with Tord. And certainly there are other players doing this that aren't as popular and aren't as streamed as much as Tord. But Tord is kind of the poster child, again, because he is on stream multiple times every tournament that he goes to that is streamed, right? If he's doing well, obviously.
And is playing Guardi every time.
Right. And is playing the same deck, right? Like, he's not out here busting out Maridon, right? Like, you know, it's just not happening.
No.
So...
He's sick, though.
That would be sick. Is what Tord's doing cheating?
I think that's the question, right? And part of what made us, you know, kind of bring this back up and want to talk about it this week is that, you know, it's buzzing around. I mean, like, Gabe Smart just released a video. It's got 10,000 views where he just directly calls Tord a cheater. Tord caught cheating is the title of the video with a question mark. And it is Tord's face. It is Tord's hand with a red circle around a pal pad. It's like, okay, that's about as brazen as it gets. It's like, and then you get into the video and it's a little bit more of a nuanced discussion. But, you know, that is...
kind of thumbnail action. Obviously implying he palmed a card on the thumbnail.
Yeah.
Not the case.
I'd be livid if someone made a video like that about me and I had not been cheating. Okay, because like that, you're basically calling, you're saying he's cheating. There it is.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I kind of do think what he's doing is cheating, but the problem is the rule in of itself is kind of a fuzzy rule, right? So the rule is you know, that you can't change your pace of play based to like accommodate a game state, basically. Like, you can't try and slow down with the goal of preventing a game from finishing. The problem is, though, like, how do you prove that you're slowing down specifically with that intention? You know, in a losing spot, you are more likely to like be thoughtful about your actions and like try and finagle the game out however you might be able to. And like, how do you objectively, definitively prove that that's what Tord is doing? You can make all sorts of arguments like, oh yeah, like obviously he's doing it with the intent of this game not finishing. And like, yeah, I do think he does those actions with games, the intent of games not finishing. But like, the intent part of that argument just makes it impossible to like actually realistically enforce. And so I guess like the follow-up question becomes, is there even a possible rule set around slow play that doesn't involve a chess timer that is enforceable, right? Is it ever possible to like truly enforce like this kind of game behavior?
No, it's not. No. It's not. I mean, you think about sports. Okay, here's an example. Most recent example, Notre Dame fans. Last play of the game, Ohio State, Notre Dame this last weekend. Notre Dame's caught on the field with 10 players, okay? It ultimately, if they had an 11th player, would it have changed the outcome? Hard to say, because Ohio State was at the half-yard line and just needed to get into the end zone to win the game, right? So, but coach comes out later and says, you know what? We should have had a hand signal for our defense to intentionally take a penalty such that we could reset to get that 11th player on the field. So in that scenario, are they cheating as the Notre Dame football team by intentionally taking a penalty, which penalties are supposed to signify game-breaking actions?
Right.
Right. So is that cheating? And I think a lot of people would say, no, that's not cheating. Like, that's just gamesmanship. That's just making sure that you're taking advantage of every possible opportunity that is laid out in front of you. And I think that is the exact same thing that we're seeing when these conversations come up. Is somebody slow playing? Is somebody, you know, working around the rules? Well, sure, they're working around the rules, or they're working to the, you know, boundaries of the rules. But is it cheating? I don't think we can make that argument. And I think it's just such a weird argument to make, because we don't say the same thing in sports if somebody tries to gain that type of advantage, but we do say it in trading card games. It just seems like a double standard to me.
I fundamentally get where you're coming from. I do think it is worth noting it is explicitly in the rules that you aren't supposed to be doing this kind of thing, right? With the intent of like drawing games to time, right? Which is different than like, there's no explicit rule in football saying that you cannot get a penalty and then put an 11th player on the field, right?
Like, sure.
So, you know,
I mean, I guess,
but I get the stance that you're taking. I do, you know, play within the confines that you're given. And that's what Tord is doing, right? He realizes that this rule is not truly enforceable unless you take it to egregious extents. And so he pushes that boundary, like as far as he thinks it is safe to take it.
And that's the problem with the rule, is that there's a general guideline of 15 seconds per game action, right? But everybody knows that that doesn't actually even exist, because everybody, you know, sees people take a minute on their first deck search, right? And it's like, okay, so 15 seconds didn't matter then. And like, but some game actions are quicker and some game actions are a little bit slower. And everybody kind of understands that, right? But it's the problem is at the end of the game, where you're playing cards and taking 10 seconds and playing another card and taking 10 seconds and doing a little shuffle here. And then I'm going to think, and then I'm going to look at my hand, and then I'm going to think, and then I'm going to play another card and do another deck search where nothing changes. And it's like, okay, the rule was 15 seconds, right? But like, you are doing things in a way where it's like, you're maybe not trying to finish the game. And the problem is, in the video that, you know, was created this week, is that Tord took a 4.5 minute turn on stream at the end of the game. If his opponent had 3 prizes remaining in game 2, right? And if Tord's turn concludes at any time in the 4.5 minutes, right? If Tord's turn concludes, then his opponent will be turn 0 and he'll have enough time to finish the game. But his opponent at this point is just like rapid fire, just like, you know, attack, go, you know, and then, you know, to contrast that against Tord, who is just like, I'm gonna just take my merry time for sure. And it's like, and Tord is not obligated to play at the opponent's pace, but I think that Tord is airing out this issue with the game, in that pace of play is an impossible rule to enforce. And it is wrapped up in politics. It's wrapped up in favoritism. It's wrapped up in whoever is judging. Remember, we had a world championships not too long ago have slow play penalty Yeah, like literally in the finals of Worlds.
Henry, yeah, that was really rough to see because there was there was a knockout and Shintaro was trying to figure out who to promote, which Pokemon to promote. From what I remember, he was asked by a judge to make a decision, took a few extra seconds to just make sure that it was correct, and then ultimately was issued a slow play before a penalty before he could put up his Pokemon. And it did really change the outcome of that game.
And you have that contrasted with like what's happening right now with Tord, not like no warnings, right? And it's like, whoa, you know, to go from seeing like a slow play penalty just kind of smack down in the finals of Worlds, and nobody liked that. People were like, whoa.
Everybody at the stadium, yeah, it was.
Right.
Yeah.
But we don't even want these penalties to be enforced, right? We don't. So then the consequence is then you have the other side of the coin, which is where the time is being explicitly taken advantage of. So the rules need to be changed. And that's just kind of, I think, exactly where the state of things is. The rules need to be changed. 50-minute best of three is a broken system for the Pokemon TCG. It is not working. I do not think that there is a solution that works for it. And I think it's got to go to either single game Swiss or best of two Swiss or some other system that determines points for each round.
Best two out of three, I think, was really great. Like you mentioned before, for a VMAX era, for an ADP era, that you were just taking prizes. Potentially, you're finishing the game in three turns, two attacks. Very good for that style of format. But now we have much more intricate decks. You have a lot of more, more stage twos, more actions. You have Lost Box that's doing a lot of things. You have Guardi that's doing a lot of things. And even the fast decks like Mew or Maridon can do a lot of things in their turn. So might be worth revisiting. Certainly is not something that Pokemon has shied away from in terms of changing the tournament structure. And hopefully there is some, kind of conclusion to solving this problem, because yes, it is a big issue right now. It is a big issue. There's thousands of dollars on the line for this kind of stuff. And hopefully we can get this sorted out.
I also just want to explicitly call out, I pulled up the handbook on the side here. JW and Andrew, you both mentioned the 15 seconds. I just want to also be clear, you can't take 15 seconds on every action, don't do that ever in a tournament. This is a quote, players attempting to compartmentalize their turn in order to consistently use every second of the time allowed for these actions, 15 seconds, will be subject to penalties associated with stalling. So, that's kind of the thesis through which all of this is being analyzed. And again, that's why I do believe that a Tord is abusing the rules of the game. So, on the face of it, though, my personal preference would be best of two. I think that's a great compromise, and it rewards players for actually finishing games of Pokemon, which is what we want, right? We want games to finish. So
it is. And I think there's a couple other notes I have before we end up pivoting. I think the element of RNG, that's serious concern. I get it with single game Swiss, and that you don't want randomness to decide your tournament. It is a game where randomness is involved. There's no eliminating that. We are not chess. If you like a game without as much randomness, chess is going to probably be that game for you. This is a card game. There's going to be some level of randomness. But something that I think was really interesting, Chris Fulop, who is a Worlds finalist who happens to live in Northeast Ohio, brought it up to me. He's a big, he's an old-time player. He's been playing for literally ever. And he's an advocate of single game Swiss, as is Michael Pramawat, who just finished in the top four of the World Championships. He is also a big advocate of single game Swiss. So you've got some old-time big-name players in the Pokemon TCG who are on this train. And I was chatting up Chris Fulop at a League Cup the other day, and he said, yes, you have a little bit more RNG in your individual matchups, but if you get to play more rounds, say you get to play 12, 13 rounds of Swiss, right? Your matchup variance is decreased. And what happens is if you're only playing 9 Swiss rounds and you hit 2 bad matchups, that very much defines your tournament experience. Whereas if you're playing 13, 14 rounds and you hit 2 bad matchups, that does not as much define your tournament experience. So that really hit home for me. You know what? Actually more rounds, getting to see more different decks is going to give you a better spread of the room more often than 9 rounds will. And I thought that was a pretty compelling argument for me.
Yeah. So I mean, I think this is a really interesting discussion. I don't think it's going to end anytime soon either. I think as the Scarlet and Violet format in particular continues to go on and we get more of these evolution cards, it's going to force people to think more and more about, you know, what time really means in the Pokemon trading card game. But speaking of time, now sounds like as good a time as any to thank our sponsor for this week's episode. Am I right, guys?
Absolutely. The presenting sponsor of the Tag Team Pokemon podcast is Manscaped. We are so happy to continue our partnership with Manscaped. And while we can't reveal any details, they do have some pretty exciting products coming out at the end of the year. So stay tuned for those. But what they do have is amazing. You can always check out manscaped.com to see the entire list of products. We love their boxer. Absolutely fantastic. We love all the different ways to, you know, remove hair in, you know, electric ways.
So true, man. Loves
hair. I'm big into the lawnmower, you know. It's really, really convenient, especially with the you know, with the little light that comes on it.
It takes care of you, man. It really does.
Yeah. I mean, really allows me to like get just, you know, a good shot of what I'm doing down there, you know.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like you have, you know, a lot to teach our listeners. But one thing that I do also want to say is you can get 20% off plus free shipping on these items. Riley, where can they find that?
Absolutely. You can find on manscaped.com. Head over there in your browser of choice. Pick whatever you want. Throw it in your cart. And if you use the code TAGTEAM at checkout, TAGTEAM, you can get not only 20% off, but like JW said, free shipping. Nobody wants to pay for shipping in current year. That's just ridiculous. So use our code, 20% off, free shipping, supports the podcast. And you get a great product to go alongside with it. It's seriously good stuff. Like, I wouldn't endorse them continuously if I didn't enjoy what I'm getting. Thank you so much to Manscaped as well for continuing to sponsor the cast. And thanks to you all for checking them out. Okay. Shifting gears a little bit. There was a regional this past weekend over in Brazil. And I don't think people were ready for the makeup of this top eight. GW, can you lay out what things look like in the top eight of Curitiba?
Yeah, pretty normal for the most part. You know, you got a Gardevoir deck. Nothing crazy there. You got
one Gardevoir as expected. Yeah.
Lost Zone, yeah. Giratina. Nothing crazy there. Okay, an Arceus deck that, you know, that's kind of fallen out of favor recently, but certainly, you know, NAIC, we had an Arceus Umbreon deck up there at the top too. The rest of the decks, all Charizard.
Five, to be clear, five Charizards in top eight. So completely insane.
Yeah, and it was very interesting, right? Because you had two separate Charizard lists. There's the one that came out originally, popularized by Andrew, which was this Arceus Charizard Pidgeot deck. And you're using Arceus to get going early, maybe set up a Pidgeot, which is going to, you know, snowball you into the late game as you're continuing to search out any specific cards. The idea there is just that, you know, maybe Charizard could even power up an Arceus. You can get that turn two attack a little bit easier. And just there's all this synergy with searching out cards from the deck that everything just kind of works together to... Early game is set with the Arceus, and then you have the late game with the Charizard as your attacker. Another Charizard deck that had emerged recently that didn't fare too well in Brazil was the Lost Zone Charizard, and this used the Lost Zone engine with your Cramorant as an early attacker to just kind of, you know, put a little bit of pressure on the opponent. You're building up a big hand with your Colruses until you can get into one or two Charizards and set up a checkmate scenario into your opponent's board.
It's also worth calling out Sableye fixes a lot of Charizard's awkward math.
That's a really great point. And you can have a nice board of one prizers until you get those, you know, big Charizards set up and maybe disrupt the opponent. The deck that we have to call out, and you've probably already seen this if you watched any content on YouTube, because this is a very novel way to build Charizard, but it is you know, kind of taking that core of Charizard EX and the Pidgeot EX without the Arceus. So there are some players that had decided the Arceus was just not really fitting in with the synergy of the deck, decided to cut it in favor of, I mean, really, you look at the list and it's like favoring Arvin for that search, favoring the Forest Sealstone to attach to either a Lumineon or an Entei V as kind of a, you know, kind of an in-between, right? Of like not having Arceus versus having Arceus. And maybe there's this middle ground of like Arvin and Forest Sealstone that acts somewhat like it, that gives you a little bit more versatility in some of the other cards that you can play. So this list came into its four at the Brazil, you know, at this regional in Brazil. And it's really, I think, you know, one of the better Charizard lists that I've seen, and I've been playing with it quite a bit, trying to wrap my head around it, and it's really worked out well.
Yeah, it's funny too, because like in some ways Arvin gets you anything that you would realistically be grabbing with Starbirth, right? Because you're getting probably a rare candy or an Ultra Ball, right? Like the missing piece of that equation. And then you have a Forest Sealstone, which will take your V-Star power to get whatever the other card you want, you know? So Arvin in of itself is always a guaranteed rare candy Charizard if you have access to Forest Sealstone, right? Because you can get the candy Forest Sealstone for Charizard, or Ultra Ball Forest Sealstone for rare candy. Like, you always have access to rare candy Charizard off an Arvin if you have a V Pokemon to attach it to, which means a Lumineon is always a guaranteed Charizard, right? If you already have a Charmander in play. So that's pretty cool, and like very explosive. You know, it kind of forgoes having alternative attackers. You know, you have the Entei and you have Radiant Charizard. Otherwise, though, you're really just trying to streamline the EX and attack with it as much and as frequently as possible. I admittedly haven't played this list a lot myself, but I've played against it a lot online. It's certainly like the hot topic of the week, and it sets up very consistently. If you have a deck that can't answer a 330 HP behemoth, you're losing to that deck.
Yes. And I think I really like this winning list from Brazil. And, you know, when I was originally tooling around with stage two decks, again, I mean, because kind of like Guardi and Charizard are kind of forcing us to do that. Guardi's a different beast. It doesn't need to find the rare candies turn two, right? But pretty much everybody else is looking for those as fast as possible. So Guardi doesn't even play four.
Might not even play three.
Might not even play three. So Guardi's a different beast. But for Charizard and for all other stage two decks that don't have a broken stage one like Kirlia, they need to play the old-fashioned way, finding those rare candies. And for me, Arceus was just the way to find the rare candies. I didn't like having the Arceus in play necessarily, but it just gives you the rare candy Pidgeot or the rare candy Charizard you need in order to get moving. And if you've ever tried playing this deck without specific search like that, where you're just maybe playing Bibarel, Pidgeot, Charizard, you know, like that list just felt like a total pile. Like, you're just kind of shuffling around, and like it felt like a small miracle if you ever found a rare candy and a Charizard together, a rare candy and a Pidgeot together, and you could actually get going. But I love the look of this list because, like you guys have said, that Arvin and the Forest Sealstone gives you that immediate search that you need in order to get the deck set up and moving, and then Pidgeot quick search just takes control from there. And once you got a 330 hit point behemoth in play with a irrelevant weakness, it's going to be some very serious board stability that you've got on your hands.
Yeah, and the thing that has always impressed me about Charizard, and I lost to a Charizard deck in Pittsburgh. You know, it certainly is something that, you know, people have been playing. It just hasn't seen a ton of success at the majors in the States, and now we're kind of starting to see these new builds crop up, both in tournament play and certainly online, people copying it. But one of the things that does really impress you about Charizard, and is the selling point of the deck, is that late game checkmate scenario that they can set up. If I'm playing against a Charizard deck and they have two Charizards down, that's like pretty much it, right? Like, that's the end game that they're trying to get to. And most of the time they're going to win that game. And so if you disrupt them enough, if you, you know, are able to maybe go through a Charizard really quick before it gets meaningful damage or something like that, and they aren't able to set up a third, like, there are some scenarios where that doesn't equate to a win, but in most cases, getting the double Charizard down just spells game over for most decks that it plays against.
And I would agree with that as well, right? Because when you think of Charizard, most decks that can't knock it out, like, Miraidon can with a real big stretch of energy on a Raichu. Gardevoir can. But otherwise, like, Charizard's basically guaranteed to take a hit unless it's slinging off like a Shaymin V or something. So Charizard can take those like 2-for-2 trades early game, even when its damage is a little weaker, as long as you have the follow-up Charizard, which will then be doing more damage and now be trading like 4-for-2, right? And it's just so brutal, like how quickly it ramps up. And in addition to like the HP and the damage that it's doing, it powers itself up. I think also an important call that I want to make is Path to the Peak is significantly less played now than people were really expecting it to be at the start of the format, which has allowed people to play these much greedier Charizard lists, right? Like relying on Arvin and stuff would not be viable if you were expecting like Path to the Peak to be everywhere. But because that's not super in vogue right now, you can get away with just playing like Tulosity and some Vacuums and Arvins as your primary supporter. Because you're not really worried about your Charizard and Pidgeot getting stunted anymore. And, you know, you look at the makeup of this cut, and yeah, that's like a reasonable call to make. There was, what, one Path to the Peak in the entire top eight? One copy of Path to the Peak in the entire top eight outside of the Giratina deck, which obviously Giratina is like featuring Path. So I think it's just like a really well, it was well positioned at that tournament in general, Charizard was. And this build of it, more than any, like took advantage of that position.
We should talk about that. What makes Charizard well positioned in a metagame? I think you kind of alluded to a lack of Path to the Peak, but are there any other factors that, you know, or decks that, you know, kind of have to this point in other metagames maybe stifled Charizard?
I've always felt like, yes, Charizard doesn't like Path. I mean, you look at, you know, places where Charizard's doing well. You look at places where Charizard's not really showing up. And I mean, in Japan, I feel like it's not nearly as big of a deck. And I felt like I've been seeing a lot of Path in Japan still right now.
Yeah.
And it makes sense with Mew EX legal, which is the meta that we are going to be playing in Peoria, right, in just about a week and a half's time. So we haven't actually gotten a great look at, you know, that meta stateside yet, which I think is going to be really interesting come Peoria. But I've always felt like Giratina V-Star Lost Box was just a horrible matchup for Charizard. And if that deck was getting punted around at Pittsburgh, then that could really, I feel like, open the floodgates for Charizard to do well.
Yeah, it is interesting to note that Charizard did beat Giratina in the finals in spite of sort of the meta call that was made and the fact that Giratina is sort of that deck into Charizard. You know, I don't have like pure through line vision into the finals and what happened there. Like maybe there's some weird stuff going on, but it was able to overcome the matchup all said and done. Though you could also make the argument that Giratina probably played one or more Charizards to get there. I think another deck that's worth considering that I believe has a decent Charizard matchup is the Inteleon Urshifu deck, which continues to be kind of like that off meta pick. Yoga Loop the Manaphy, and all of a sudden you're rapid flowing the next turn to Manders and life is miserable. So I think that's another deck that can really put the hurt on Charizard unless they get up really, really fast, which is possible, right? Like, especially if they go first. But I think that's another deck that can really put the pressure on, if nothing else.
Well, you mentioned going first with the Charizard deck. I think there's actually a lot of scenarios that you don't want to go first. And this is kind of sure. You know, some similar logic with that we've had with Miraidon, but...
And Lost Index as well.
And Lost Index. There might be a reason to go second in certain matchups, especially where your opponent can take quick early prizes with Charizard, because you have your 4 VIP pass, and then you have your 4 Arvin. And I look at those cards as being very advantageous to you going second, right? Because if you don't start a VIP pass, you can Arvin for 1. If you do have a VIP pass and an Arvin, then you just have a full board. Because what I've found is going first, if you don't hit that VIP pass,
you're hurting.
You can be in a world of hurt. And there's not a lot. And we think about like, Gardevoir. That's a deck that does want to go first and that also plays Battle VIP Pass and also is a stage two deck. But there's a litany of other ways to fill the bench on the first turn without Battle VIP Pass. Of course, you have Ultra Ball. That is kind of a tough one in Charizard because you're getting rid of resources that you otherwise want to keep. You have, though, in Gardevoir, you have your Fog Crystal, you have your Level Ball, and then you have most of your Pokemon with one retreat to get into a Mew.
So and Mirage Step, even if you happen to still.
And Mirage Step if you get a, you know, if you stumble out of the gates, right? So there's a lot of different tools that Gardevoir has access to you know, get that board established. Charizard, I think one of the weaknesses that I haven't really heard people talk about, but the more I've played the deck, the less that I've wanted to go first against very aggressive decks. So these are the Fusion Mews. These are the Lost Boxes. These are the Maridons. I think you actually do, and you know, arguably even the Lasso and Giratina decks, I think that you probably want to go second in those matchups just so that you have access to four more cards to be able to fill that bench, you know, with gaining access to the Arvin. Because a lot of times, you know, if you're going off the winning list, if you're playing that winning list, you got four VIP pass, you got two Nest Ball, and the Ultra Balls you really want to be saving for the Pidgeot, for the Charizard. You don't want to be wasting those first turn of the game, depleting your own resources in hand to try to get your board set up. It's just, it's kind of, yeah, it gets really awkward. If you haven't played with the deck, I think there are some strong situations where a certain matchup say you want to go second.
Playing Zorobox at the Cup this weekend, by the end of the Cup, I had realized that pretty much against every single deck, it was optimal to choose go second. And it was because you just run the risk of getting run off the board going first. And that's in a deck that plays four Nest Ball and four Level Ball. And you just might not open enough of them. And then all of a sudden you have like this super weak setup. But having access to your supporters turn one just changes it and allows you to really have a more explosive setup and allows you to... I think it really boils down to, does this deck want to play a supporter card before the opponent starts attacking? And I think a lot of decks are going to start saying yes to that, which means you would want to choose to go second because there are a plenty of decks that can attack turn one in the format now.
Yeah, right. Absolutely.
That's fair. So I think another interesting development from, you know, Curitiba is the complete absence of Lugia after Lugia performed so well stateside. Was Lugia just a knee-jerk reaction in the States? You know, I also think back to like Worlds Day One where Lugia was super popular and also didn't perform well. Is Lugia just not worth people's time? You know, why is it just continuing to not put up numbers despite even having deep runs in Pittsburgh but getting obliterated by Jesse?
I think no one actually likes playing Lugia. I'm going to put that out there. Nobody likes Lugia. And for that matter, nobody really loves...
Couple people.
Nobody really loves... Nah. And even the people that do tolerate it...
Coping.
The Aroma flips and the Mezagoza flips. I mean, it's enough to make it. And then the discards with the Tyranitar. Holy smokes. I mean, you're really just spinning the wheel and it... feels really bad. There's not a lot of players I know who have a tolerance for that level of RNG in their RNG game. So I think it's a combination of that and a combination of the fact that the deck just ran home with its tail between its legs right after Pittsburgh. And it's like, who's roaring to pick up?
Did it though? I mean, a top eight and a top four? Like, it ran home
publicly by Maridon. And then Maridon was a huge percentage of the field. Like, who wants to be
fair, getting smashed by Maridon is a bad look.
think of like the morale. Like, you were going into Pittsburgh thinking Maridon's not real, and then the boogeyman is real. Oh god, he's real.
I feel that. So I guess the follow-up question is, like, is Lugia gonna stay in its grave at Peoria, or is it gonna reemerge stateside? It feels like there is a little bit more favoritism towards Lugia in the States versus other regions.
Well, we saw it do well in Japan, right? It was the runner-up of the 3,000-person tournament, losing to Maridon.
Go, Don.
But I mean, it is the deck that can abuse the new best card. Yes. from the best card from the newest set, I should say, in Mew EX, which a lot of players really like. It's tough to see it going in every deck, but the decks that can abuse it, I think it's going to be a stellar addition. And I think Lugia just fits that bill, right? It has all the pieces to make Mew a meaningful card and help it swing a lot of these matchups.
That's true. Yes. Does it swing? A swing feels like a strong word.
What is Mew doing? I mean, I think it smooths things. It gives you another option. I don't know. I think people will play Lugia. I think it'll show up. I think it'll be a top 5 or 6 deck. I think Charizard will be better represented.
I think Lugia's problem is that it can't beat Charizard that well.
Yeah.
Right?
I think Charizard will be that deck. I think Charizard's a top four deck.
What is a Lugia doing versus a Charizard EX in the active position? It can't even one hit KO it.
You're playing Breloom V and 2 Impact Energy.
No.
No, it was bad. I was looking through. I was like, what grass attacker could Lugia play? Energy. And there's a Breloom V that's grass colorless. It does 140.
No,
oh, I think. Man.
So you would need 2 impact,
single strike.
Which is
single strike energies.
Yeah, two impact, which is the color, which is the rainbow,
and 2 single strikes as well.
Yeah. So you need 4 energy.
And then the next Charizard comes up and knocks it out.
And then
you play your second Breloom and
with the last 2 impact energy. The last 2 impact energy. You earned back
the last 2 single strikes.
That's Cope, bro. No, you use Mew to knock out the final one.
If they're at 1 prize.
Yeah. Well, you think you'd use
Justify Gloves, bro. I'm telling you, Justify Gloves. Justify Gloves is like. No, in any deck, unironically, Justify Gloves might. I mean,
you can also play Cobalion.
Cleansing Gloves saw play. Yeah, yep. You could play Cobalion, right? I
don't think that's a bad idea, Andrew, because you get to that 4 prize turn for the Charizard, and then you're knocking out with the Mew, and I think that's very reasonable to do. You can also go the kind of glass cannon route and play a. An Urshifu VMAX, single strike Urshifu VMAX, do 3-3 that way.
Jeez, I guess.
We might see, like, Lugia has these answers, right? And it's just kind of about, do you respect Charizard enough, right? Do you respect Charizard enough to play the single strike Urshifu? Do you respect Charizard enough to play the Mew and potentially a damage augmenting card alongside it? So I think but you do bring up a good point, Andrew. Like, is Charizard going to be a deck now, like heading into Peoria? Absolutely. Like, I am respecting Charizard heading into Peoria. Am I going to be playing it? Not likely. There's still a chance.
Coward.
No. And that's not to say that it's a bad deck. Coward, right?
True. Coward.
That's not saying it's a bad deck. It's, you know, there's other things that I've been cooking, but there is a level of respect that I'm giving Charizard that I hadn't in the past, all because of this one tournament bringing out a list that I, you know, the winning list, I feel like is very reasonable for a deck in this format. I feel like it can really contend. And I feel like a lot of people have had these Charizards in their binder. They thought they were really good. Tournament success didn't really pan out. Now they're ready to bring them out. I think this is going to be a hotbed, pardon the pun, for Charizard. I would predict a top 3 deck somewhere in that 12 to 15% range.
Yeah. Yeah.
People love a new toy.
Yep.
They do.
But the thing is, they didn't at, you know, there was enough doubt that they didn't play it at Pittsburgh, right?
Well, but look at this. Electrifying. 5 out of 8, you know?
Yeah.
It won.
Yeah. Well, I mean, because
we that's not even so much the new toy as like the new hotness, right? Like this.
Well, but
the,
I mean, we saw the same thing with Maridon, right? Maridon was nowhere. And then it gets a couple of top 32s at Worlds. And then now you see it everywhere. You know, I say, see it everywhere. And it's not like taking any credit, but it was a zero deck. Like, it was zero.
That was all
nowhere.
You, man. No,
not
that
on
was
the
all
radar.
You, buddy.
Yeah, thank you. That was, yeah. I'll take a little bit of credit. Yeah. It was nowhere. It was nothing. There was nothing. Zero zip, nada. has a couple of results, not even part, you know, top two, top 32s at Worlds, not like incredible results, not like 5 out of 8 at a regional. And it's still, you know, okay, people have opened the floodgates, right? Sometimes all it takes is one player or two players to have a result with a deck to legitimize it in the eyes of the masses. And I think we'll see with Charizard.
I'm with you. I'm just saying it's not quite new toy syndrome in the fact that it's like, it's not just like Charizard just came out and people are rearing to play it. It's that they are now validated that it's a possible deck that they can play and they're ready to charge forward.
My argument is that the toy that is new
is the build.
The deck list. Yeah. Yes, it's not the Charizard. Charizard, people were excited about Charizard. That's that in some ways, that's new toy syndrome. Yes, but now it's like people have the new list. New list.
Yes.
New list. Yes. Yes. I sling this baby right into TCG Live and oh, I got the exact 60 right here. I spent my credits on it. Yes.
TCG Live makes it too easy to go on the ladder with Charizard deck, man. You get most of it for free.
Now I play against 60% Charizard decks on the ladder.
Well, okay, easy. So here is, I think we should take the last couple minutes, just talk about if Charizard's real, what does the rest of the meta look like? Because I think we hit on, okay, maybe Path is a little underplayed. In response, do we see Path become a little more played? Do we see players, you know, really switch up their decks? Do we go back to maybe, you know, more Giratina-based decks, whether that's Lost Zone Giratina or, dare I even say it, Arceus Giratina? There's a few things. Are there people trying to fit grass attackers into their Lost Box list to target down Charizard? Like, where do you see the metagame going from here? Now that, again, we're kind of predicting for Peoria, Charizard would be certainly a top 5 deck. I don't think that there's any way. I don't think that there's any way that Charizard's not a top 5 deck. Like, you are probably going to be playing 1 to 3 rounds of Charizard day one, just because, again, of how much we would expect it. And certainly, I think, could break into that top 3. So, with that in mind, where do you see the meta going?
I think first and foremost, I want to make something clear. Don't play Arceus Giratina. Further discussion can resume.
Arceus decks are still bad. All right, now you might be thinking it's time to build an arc pile. I tried that.
I know you're thinking it. Just put the grass attacker in there. Save yourself the time and the trouble.
Arc pile with Shaman.
No.
Arc Pidgeot, Shaman, Uriahan, Shaman, and then
no arc file.
It can have an answer to everything, Riley.
I know. I've been there so many times. It's not worth it. So I'm gonna see the floor, but I really want to put that out there. Just don't play the arc file.
I think I've spent the last couple weeks right. I guess when was this regional? Was it this past weekend? I guess so, right? Yeah.
Yeah, it's like 4 days ago, man.
every day on TCG Live feels like eternity.
It's a week and it's in itself.
Bro, I streamed for like 8 hours on live the other day and I think I melted my brain cells. Yeah.
This is like a classic. Have you guys seen the meme, like, what a week, Captain? Or like, what a week?
Yeah, Captain. What a week, Wednesday. Brother, it's Wednesday. Like, literally, I'm like 2 weeks. Oh, God. It's
what a
four
month,
days.
Dude. What a month it's been at Charizard.
Frankly, yes. So that has been, it's been a heck of a 4 days here playing against these decks. But they're scary. And if you don't have something that deals with them, they will set up on you. You will have to knock out 3 of them, and it will be a nightmare. You know, you maybe got 1 Pidgeot EX you can, you know, cheap shot, and then maybe only have to knock out 2. But these things are scary. They will go. I think every time I get them, I get down to my final 2 prizes, and I'm like, how much damage did it do? Holy 300, good God. Every single time. I'm like doing the math, I'm like 3, 6, 9, 12, plus 180. That'll do it.
Yeah.
It's scary. It is very scary. The board is sparse. There's not a lot of, they sometimes have Luminion, but these dudes are scary. It's tough.
Yeah. So I guess what do you think can respond to Charizard then? You know, you've been playing a lot. Clearly, you had your 8-hour session the other day. What can handle the heat?
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's the question. I'm not comfortable playing.
Oh, come on. It's not like it's a good deck.
I'm not comfortable playing Maridon into it.
It's not like a crazy deck. It's not a crazy deck. I mean, I feel like what I'm hearing from you, Andrew, is like, oh, it's the best deck ever created. Like, it's not that. It's a good deck. It's a very high tier 2 deck that I think we'll see a lot of play. Bro.
You think it's tier 2 still?
I think it's high tier 2. Yep. Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
So what do you think, Ben? What do you think is kind of occupying that
Hero? Well, now you're going to challenge me now just because I gave one dissenting opinion. Now you're going to ask
me. I'm asking what your opinion is. So,
go through the list, all right? Yeah. I'm not comfortable playing Mew VMAX into this Charizard realm. Okay.
Here's what I'm thinking, okay? Before, and this is with the caveat that I have played. I haven't played against this exact build, but in my experience with against Charizard with other decks, here's what I would consider reasonable, like favorable into Charizard. Decks that have favorable matchups into Charizard. So I would say Maridon with Path. I would say Arctina. I would say Tina. I would say Lost Box. Again, just the speed. Those are like kind of the four decks. Like, I don't think Lost Box is particularly afraid of Charizard. And I would expect Lost Box players to play a Mew. And they're playing a single prize game anyway, so they will get that two prizes at the end of the game. Guaranteed. Those are some of the decks that I look at. Like, a couple that play... Three that play Path. And then one, like, Lost Box, I think, is just still going to be good. Maybe they play a Hawlucha to counter the 70 HP Charmanders or whatever, so they're taking two prizes there. They might take two prizes with a Greninja, and then they're certainly taking their last two prizes with the Mew EX. I think that's where I'm looking. Like, Lost Box players, you're safe.
How is this is this not a tier one deck if Guardi's afraid of it, Mew VMAX is afraid of it?
Actually, Guardi, I don't even think Guardi is afraid of it, right? Because you force them to go first and you just set up better and you have a one prizer that blows them up. They have to consistently find boss. And we've seen that Guardi. What's that?
Not hard.
Well, yeah, but then I can knock out your Pidgeot. Like, you know, I can either knock out your main dude or I can knock out your Pidgeot. Like, Pidgeot's a free two prizes, and I can knock it out with a one prizer. Right? Like, this is the game plan. I neglected to mention Guardi, but I do feel like Guardi has a solid matchup into Charizard. Again, especially like going second. And if they brick, which just try it out, like go second with go first with the Charizard deck that has been winning. You're going to find that you don't set up very well. And Guardi can absolutely take advantage of that. But I think even going first, Guardi is just more consistent, faster, and can one-shot with a one-prizer.
Yeah, I think I do agree with you that Guardi can keep up with Zard. I do think if Zard gets out of the gates first,
What do you mean, get out of the gates fast? What are you talking about? Favorite. There's reversal energy, bro. That's like the ultimate, like...
Well, the problem is you still need all those energy in the discard pile, right? Like, you still need all those energy in the discard pile, and Zard is able just to continuously stream that, like, for free.
If Zard gets a turn to attack, it's usually ugly for Guardi.
And you saw this, like, you saw the difference in that, like, in the slow play game that we were talking about, that Torb played against the Charizard, right? Sure. Where, like, they got a Zard up, like, on turn two, and... It was like an unbeatable game state, you know? and then we saw the Palpatine situation going on, you know? I think Zard is still favorite. I do think Guardi can keep up, like that Torb won the game one, for example. I think the general aptitude of the Charizard deck is favored versus the general game plan of the Guardi deck. Yeah, I mean, I don't know if I agree with all of your statements. I don't think Arc Giratina, for example, is a viable choice to bring to a tournament, period. I'm not really trying to attack with Arceus and then attack with Giratina my following turn, but that's just me. I'm just built different like that. So.
Yeah, true. One other deck. What if we talked about DTE Mew?
Absolutely not with the Charizards, man.
You like, got four path, bro.
Grab. The problem is that they bumped that path four grabbies.
Yeah, you grab.
grabbing the Pidgeot.
Put Charizard bottom of the deck. Judge, Pat, grab it.
JW, be honest. How many games have you played with Grabber? You were so excited for it last week.
Yeah.
How many games have you played with Grabber since then?
10.
That is,
I think I'm at like
pretty
a
low. Pretty low, buddy.
7-3 record or so.
Okay. But
it's been fun.
You're grabbing. I
mean, when it hits, bro. When it hits, when you grab her.
when you be grabbing.
When you grab her,
they don't forget.
Yeah, there's nothing
they don't
better.
Forget. Yeah, no, that's
yeah, that's right. That's
nobody right. forgets the first time they get grabbered. Yikes.
And then you hit them with the thumbs up emote.
Oh. Judge, grabber.
Yeah. Yeah, man, I'd be yapping to my friends in the group chat after that one for sure. That's fair. So yeah, I guess DTMU and grabber is also, you know, kind of the way. I think next week we'll have a lot of really exciting stuff with Peoria coming up on the radar. So I'm super excited to see where things go from here. Charizard coming out of left field at the very tail end of the Obsidian Flames format was not the twist I was expecting, but I welcome a meta shift. I always think it's fun to see how the game responds. So I'm excited to see where things develop over the next week. Andrew, JW, any final words of wisdom for our listeners out there who are looking for sage advice?
Just play your favorite deck.
Yeah, put down the Wigglytuff. So.
Yeah,
absolutely not. Wigglytuff is the only card that could survive that five prize Charizard. So
I am now, you know, last week, God, how far we've come since last week. I've played some games,
man,
with Tuff.
What
no,
a year.
No. Yeah, what a year. But last week, Riley said that Wigglytuff could top 64 regional. I'm saying JW was right. That card is so pits. Hey, nothing good happening with that thing.
Look, man, someone needed to take the Wigglytuff stance for content. and I was willing to be that guy.
Held the sword.
Because I had the talking points ready to go. So I'll stand by them too. So when
is Wigglytuff the answer to Charizard? We'll leave you with that. Is it? Might be.
Only one way to find out. We'll catch you all next week. Be sure to check us out on social media. You can find Andrew at EnjoyFriend, JW at RealJohnWalter. And myself at Smiles with Riles. The Tag Team Podcast is also present on the Twitter app at Tag Team Pokemon. We also record the podcast live every single week at twitch.tv/FlexDaddyRighteous. And you may be listening to this on YouTube. If not, you can find it there at Andrew's YouTube channel, Tricky Jim. Again, thank you all so much for listening and the consistent support. And we'll catch you all next week. Peace.
See ya.